army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. Today, I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 73 of Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast. The title of this particular episode is Modern Antifa, Communist Insurgency in the U.S., Part 2. So a little bit of housekeeping. I am a member of the Libertarian Institute. I am the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs there, working for Scott Horton. Scott Horton has embarked upon an academy called the Scott Horton Academy, a university college and log, and he retained me as a visiting lecturer, and he chartered me with doing a course. The course that I developed for the Scott Horton Academy is called American Stalemate and Defeat 1945 to 2025. I have completed that. They have completed the video, the audio, the titling, and all the stuff that goes into putting together a multi-hour course. Learned a lot in that process, hoping to take what I learned and maybe embarking on other ventures. I also know that I'll be doing other courses for Scott in the near or intermediate future. As I've made you aware in the past, we are moving the bunker complex from our present location to one a little north to the panhandle of Florida, where I will be closer to my beloved sons. So that being the case, I have packed away my library, and little did I know that my library was so bloody invaluable to me for these podcasts and making sure that my renderings, historical analysis, and quest to develop the single most accurate picture of what we're discussing here is good. So I have started using a public library for the very first time, probably in decades. And if you haven't visited one lately, I would urge you to pay a visit to it because I was able to find, fortunately, because of my arcane and exotic reading material that I usually get, for the most part, everything that I needed was there, and those things that I needed that weren't there, they could order them for me. So, again, it sounds like a public service announcement, doesn't it? But nonetheless, your local library, one of the very few things that I can support government tax dollars going to. So let's get on with this episode. We are presently in the midst of a communist insurgency, whether this is recognized or not, by the authorities, by the government, by the coprophile media, by the talking heads, whoever it may be out there that's trying to put brightly covered gift wrapping, legerdemain, and misdirection on what Antifa and its affiliates is actually all about. So what I discovered here is that when I embarked on this journey to figure out what the hell is Antifa, are they an organization? Where do they come from? What are their historical roots, whether in the U.S. or in Canada or globally, and where do they come from? So in the last episode, we discussed their roots in Germany and the exportation of the communist ideas through both the Soviet Union and probably 10 years after the establishment of communist China, Chinese internationalist things that occurred to influence almost a debating society, a Judean People's Front and a People's Front of Judea between the Marxist-Leninist of the Soviet Union and the Maoist of China. And we will see further on in this episode that that very schism is one thing that split the Weathermen and the Weather Underground in half. Also, I'd like to repeat something that I discovered when I was researching the last episode, is that the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was established apparently in 1940 and disestablished in 1975, has 35 years of documentation and archives at the National Archives and several universities. I think I elucidated those in the last episode. And it would be great, and I'm not the guy raising his hand to volunteer for this job. I do wish that Harvey Clare, who I consider the godfather of the historiographer, that is K-L-E-H-R, the godfather of American historiography on the 20th century communist movement in America, I do wish his heirs, confreres, or maybe academic fellows who are young enough could go there with a forklift, get that stuff, hire interns, hire researchers, and comb through that 35 years of investigating communism in America. The fruits it will yield will probably be incredible. And keep in mind that if you ask yourself, the Hollywood blacklist, which is legendary, McCarthy was rude. McCarthy was ill-mannered. He was a bit slovenly, and he wasn't the best researcher. But it turns out that McCarthy was right, because in government, media, and entertainment, communism was an accepted political philosophy that animated so many people across America. I mentioned in the last episode that the 1930s were the electoral high tide of American communism. I recall seeing a 1938 photo with a portrait of Lincoln that was several stories high at the Communist Party USA National Convention in 1938. It was the 10th annual convention, if I recall, in Chicago at the time. And if you're curious, why would there be a several stories high figure or representation of Lincoln at a Communist Party meeting? It's because Marx was a great admirer of Abraham Lincoln for a lot of reasons that we don't have to get into here. But let's just say, to a certain extent, Marx viewed Lincoln and his behavior during the War of Northern Aggression from 1860 to 1865 as a proto-Soviet icon. So I think that I acquainted my listeners with the fact that there has always been a vibrant and rather large intellectual and philosophical community that aligns itself with communist, uppercase C, in the case of the Communist International under the Soviet Union, with Stalin and what he did to infiltrate the West, and then the lowercase c for the Marxist, the Marxist-Leninist, the Maoist, and all the flavors of communism that one would find in a book that I recommend be on every bookshelf, which is the Black Book of Communism, which describes from a global standpoint just how awful it was stacking corpses like cordwood to the count of approximately 160 million in the 20th century alone, and why, despite its popularity, and that popularity continues, unfortunately, at its base, it is a moral hazard and a death cult. Why are intellectuals continuously attracted to the notions of communism and socialism? To paraphrase Paul Johnson in his book on intellectuals, intellectuals, for the most part, always think that they are smarter than the rest of us and know that if they were put in charge of our lives, that we would all be better off under their tutelage. It's a vain conceit, a wrong conceit, but nonetheless, it is the red sword of communism that slays any kind of moral barriers within the communist mind to make them think that maybe they're on the wrong side of morality and virtue. As with all things, if you don't know where you've been, you can't possibly know where you are. So this time we're going to talk about the 1960s and 70s. In the part three of this series, I will start to accelerate towards present day. But nonetheless, I really feel that it's important for my listeners and correspondents to get a taste, a flavor, a sense of where all of this communist agitation that is presently on a megaphone all around us comes from. It doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from somewhere. So we left off at the 1950s in the House Un-American Affairs Committee, and the almost superannuated love of communism, socialism, and all the government supremacist isms under that particular rubric and umbrella, and why it continues today. So for a variety of reasons, the 1960s arrive. And with the 1960s, 15 years after the conclusion of World War II, there are lots of cultural changes occurring at a wholesale level across America and the world. The confluence of the Vietnam War, ostensibly to fight communist domination and domino shattering in Southeast Asia and such, starts to animate a lot of students who have known relative peace in America since the conclusion of the stalemate in Korea in 1953. So here we are a dozen years later, where all of a sudden in 1965, and by the way, I'll be doing further episodes on Vietnam in the future, probably next year, because next year is just around the corner, on just how much U.S. interference there was in Vietnam, because it goes all the way back to the 1930s and 40s. So radical groups in the United States really start to get in the saddle, as it were, in the 1960s and accelerate and get a lot more horsepower and exposure to their ideas than they ever got before. Now, a lot of these ideas would come from the civil rights movement, the emancipation movement, the black liberation movements. As a matter of fact, if one goes back fairly far, what you discover is that between, I think it was the 19-teens and the 1920s, there were two black-centered guerrilla movements in the United States, the African Blood Brotherhood and the Negro Improvement Association. And then you could go forward in decades, you would find Malcolm X probably being the most eloquent and well-articulated defense of these kind of black ethno-state activities in America. This would spawn the Black Liberation Army and the Black Panthers, and in turn, that civil rights struggle would start to dominate campus activism. And up until this time, activism had narrow slots of funding and narrow focus within the American community and the society at large. But it was the 1960s that brought community activism, and this kind of thing to have people who would spend all their waking hours not simply pulling political levers, as politicians do, but finding themselves not in political office, but being those who are out there in the trenches, as it were, pressing for these kind of issues under, in this case, the socialist and communist rubric. Now remember, despite the communist high tide with the Communist Party USA, part of the Communist International under Stalin at the time until 1953, when there was a renunciation of sorts, it was never accepted as a means nor an option in the American political spectrum. So something happened in the 1960s. And one of those things that I find emblematic of this is the Students for a Democratic Society, which was a national student activist organization that emerged in the 1960s and one of the principal representations of the new left. They didn't like permanent leaders, hierarchical relationships, parliamentary procedure. The founders conceived of the organization as a broad exercise in participatory democracy. From its launch in 1960, it grew rapidly in the course of the decade, with over 300 campus chapters and 30,000 supporters recorded nationwide at its last national convention in 1969. And, of course, a new national network for left-wing student organizing, also calling itself Students for a Democratic Society, was founded in 2006, but it hasn't gotten much traction. This organization had, quote, revolutionary positions on, among other issues, surprise, surprise, the Vietnam War and Black Power. Now, I want to point out something very interesting here. Daryl Cooper at MartyrMade, who I consider a colleague and I really enjoy what he puts out on his podcast, despite the jeremiads of protest against his artillery and demolitions against received history, he did a multi-part series on Jim Jones, that Jim Jones. That Jim Jones, who was not only a powerhouse in San Francisco, who helped to fund and fundraise for Democrat politicians, but he had a tremendous love, this is 1960s and 70s, for the Soviet Union and was always touting that as the model by which all human beings should live. Jim Jones crafted a letter, September 5th, 1978, a People's Temple letter to the Soviet Union. And in this letter, he said, and I'm quoting, "In conclusion, we are endeavoring in Jonestown, under the compassionate leadership and wisdom of our vast U.S. and Guyana projects administrator, Comrade Jim Jones, to not only develop as a model of communism cooperation and production, but to understand our collective as part of the International Movement for Human Liberation, which our spiritual motherland, the USSR, has pioneered in this century." End of quote. Now, that is from 1978, and we're still talking about the 1960s, but I'm talking about the resonance of the communist idea and ideal as a rallying cry for a certain slice of the American polity. Since then, that has not abated. So not only was Jim Jones a friend of the Soviet Union, but Jim Jones, along with a number of others, was sort of like the left-of-left communist agitator, white fifth columnist, organizational standard for the Black Power movement from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s until Jim Jones and many of his clients down in Guyana assumed room temperature as a result of mass seppuku with Kool-Aid. What I'm trying to point out here is that absent the Black liberation ideology and, mind you, possibly theology that was percolating in the 1950s and 60s, you would not have had what you did with the Weather Underground, the Weathermen, SDS, and the bombings and the shootings and the assassination campaigns and everything else that started to show the very violent edge and emblematic representation in the 1960s of these radical student movements. As a matter of fact, it was an early 20th century instantiation of this kind of activism called the League for Industrial Organization that was probably the predecessor and the precursor element for the Students for a Democratic Society. Well, of course, in the Students for a Democratic Society, from whence the Weathermen were born. By the way, that name, Weathermen, and then later on, Weather Underground, is based on a Bob Dylan song with the lyric, "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows." So before I get to the split between the Students for a Democratic Society and the Weathermen, which would later be the Weather Underground, I want to talk about Canadian Quebec real quick, because in the 1950s and 60s, there were bombings and all kinds of things that were going on, which led to the formation of the FLQ, the Front de Libération du Québec. It was a Quebec separatist militant group which aimed to establish an independent socialist Quebec. Of course, socialist Quebec. Founded sometime in the early 1960s, the FLQ conducted a number of attacks between 1963 and 1970, which totaled over 160 violent incidents and killed 8 people and injured many more. These attacks culminated with the Montreal Stock Exchange bombing in 1969 and the October Crisis in 1970, the latter beginning with the kidnapping of British Trade Commissioner James Cross. In the subsequent negotiations, Quebec Labor Minister Pierre Laporte was kidnapped and murdered by a cell of the FLQ. Public outcry and a federal crackdown subsequently ended the crisis and resulted in a drastic loss of support for the FLQ. Now, what later happens is the FLQ get hunted down and they flee. They flee into America and they just so happen to run into a gentleman by the name of Samuel Joseph Melville, who was born Samuel Joseph Grossman. Sam Melville, he was an American left-wing activist and terrorist who was the principal conspirator and bomb setter in the 1969 bombings of 8 government and commercial office buildings in New York City. Melville cited his opposition to the Vietnam War and U.S. imperialism as the motivation for the bombings. He pleaded guilty to conspiracy and to the bombing of the federal office building in Lower Manhattan. And as a result of that, he also assaulted a marshal in a failed escape attempt. By the way, he is a key figure in the 1971 Attica prison riots. There are books and movies out there on these riots, which had a communist flavor to them. He was shot by the police and killed when the uprising was put down by force. But I get ahead of myself. So the FLQ was fleeing through the United States, just so happened to run into Sam Melville, and Sam Melville said, look, I'll ratline you directly to Cuba if you wish and give you the contacts that you need to escape, but you must teach me how to build bombs. So a solution set was agreed upon. He became the bomb maker's apprentice, and by the way, he became the primary, and I suspect sole bomb maker for the Weathermen and the Weather Underground. He managed to get several members down to Florida, where they hijacked an aircraft to Cuba, and apparently were feted and welcomed by Castro and his regime as heroes, and the FLQ found their sanctuary in Cuba. Back to Sam Melville. So as I said, it turns out that he is the only bomber that the Weathermen and the Weather Underground. So the Weathermen would, they would number in the hundreds, but eventually, after a lot of things that we don't have to get into, it narrowed and winnowed itself into its new transmogrification of the Weather Underground with 30 or less members, of whom I'm sure you're aware that a lot of them literally got away with murder. During this time, the Weathermen and later the Weather Underground were forming their cells and forming their organizational structure to allow them to start the bombings, which would be called the Days of Rage. Brian Burrow wrote that brilliant book, Days of Rage, which you'll find in the show note. It's called Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, the FBI, and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence that occurred then. Because to a certain extent, there is an amount of amnesia that in my mind is large when it comes to the preponderance of communism as a rubric of understanding and apprehending the world in a certain sector of society that started in the 1920s and has lasted over 100 years and is still with us today. I had mentioned to you that the SDS started to break apart. The Weathermen and the Weather Underground would result from that. And there was a schism in the Students for a Democratic Society that caused this very thing to occur. That schism was between the Maoist, and mind you, I know this sounds strange to say, but the Maoists were a bit more conservative in their communism. While there was a Castroite faction, because as I've mentioned to my perennial listeners who may have listened to my episode on Venezuela, the Cubans really punch above their weight in intelligence and to a certain extent military competence and espionage when it comes to these kind of things. And one can consider that the 1970s and the 1980s were a high tide of Castroite Cuban influence in the hemispheric community of communist agitation. Remember, this is also the time in the 1960s where the Catholic Church and the Jesuits have a very large splinter group emerging using the rubric, quote, liberation theology, end quote, which was all about applying Marxist principles to communist ideas under the religious imprimatur of sectors of the Catholic Church that just so happened to yield to that. And again, what we see here is that the Maoists were much more like the International World Workers Organizations and Workers of the World Unite, a much more proletariat and proletarian-oriented organization, while the Castroites were a social justice form of coalition where race was a very big deal, unlike the Maoists who weren't concerned about it at the time. And mind you, remember, this is the end of the 1960s where the race card becomes almost this shadow preamble to the woke nonsense and woketopian tardia that we have suffered through this first quarter century of the 21st century. Everything has roots in the past, same as it ever was. It almost seems as if there's nothing new under the sun. And another thing that I want you to keep in mind, especially if you are a longtime listener of mine, is we're talking about the 1960s and 70s here with bomb making. We're talking about one bomb maker that would be Sam Melville character that I was telling you about, and none of the others in the SDS, nor the Weathermen, nor the smaller Weather Underground, wanted anything to do about that because of this curious bifurcation in communist circles between white-collar thought leaders, think Bernie Sanders, and blue-collar communists, think unionist and things like that. There's a big divide between them culturally within this entire small-c communist milieu in America, and always has been. Well, it turns out that the Maoist did not want to take such violent action, and it was the Castroites, the Cuban-influenced communist who wanted to take kinetic action in the United States. Hence, the Weathermen were born. And the Weathermen Manifesto is very interesting. EBSCO Information Services did a very compelling analysis of this very thing. Quote, the Weathermen Manifesto emerged from the radical faction of the Students for a Democratic Society during the late 1960s, a period marked by significant social turmoil in opposition to the Vietnam War. SDS initially engaged in nonviolent activism, focused on civil rights and anti-poverty efforts, but as disillusionment grew, a group within SDS, later known as the Weathermen, advocated for more militant forms of protest. The manifesto espouses a Marxist-Leninist view of the United States as an imperialist power, arguing that systemic racism, poverty, and war are inherent in its capitalist structure. The Weathermen called for alliances with oppressed communities, particularly African Americans and Third World revolutionaries, emphasizing that true change could only come through widespread revolution and not reform. The group's activities escalated to include underground bombings targeting symbols of the state and capitalism, reflecting their conviction that radical action was necessary to confront perceived injustices. The manifesto highlights a sense of urgency among young activists, catalyzed by the stark contrast between Americans' professed ideals and the realities of oppression. It also frames youth culture as a potential source of revolutionary energy, suggesting that the disaffected young people of the era could be mobilized to challenge the status quo. Overall, the Weathermen Manifesto represents a pivotal moment in the history of American radicalism, encapsulating the frustrations and aspirations of a generation seeking profound societal change. End of quote. It is rather friendly to say societal change through violence, of course, but it doesn't mention that. For those who don't know, Marxism-Leninism is a curious rubric under the umbrella rubric of communism. It was the formal name of the official state ideology adopted by the USSR, its satellite states in Eastern Europe, the Asian communist regimes, and various scientific socialist regimes in the Third World during the Cold War. As such, the term is simultaneously misleading and revealing. It is misleading, since neither Marx nor Lenin ever sanctioned the creation of an eponymous ism. Indeed, the term Marxist-Leninism was formulated only in the period of Stalin's rise to power after Lenin's death. It is revealing because the Stalinist institutionalization of Marxism-Leninism in the 1930s did contain three identifiable dogmatic principles that became the explicit model for all later Soviet-type regimes. Dialectical materialism, a mouthful, as the only true proletarian basis for philosophy, the leading role of the Communist Party as the central principle of Marxist politics, and state-led planned industrialization and agricultural collectivization as the foundation of socialist economics. End of quote. Now, one thing that you will note about me if you've listened to me long enough is that I am a severe and proud and long-standing anti-communist of any communist ideology that is out there. And I have found again and again that this ideology, a death cult, a murder hornet moral philosophy, attracts so many people through the ages. It's like a bad rash that simply doesn't go away. But that is fodder for another episode. Back to what we're talking about here. Days of Rage, to paraphrase Brian Burrow. So I want to read some excerpts from Burrow's book on what happens after 1969 and 1970 as far as bombings every day of the week or every week for months, if not years, in the United States. What's happening now is nothing new. And what disturbs me even more is that bomb making and the use of bombs in the 1950s, 60s, whether it was the Irish during the Troubles starting in 1968, the bombs that were so common but didn't take too many lives in America in the 1970s and starting in the late 1960s. If we fast forward to today, and all of a sudden this present communist insurgency that we're seeing emerge, Antifa and its affiliate organizations, starts using this, well, guess what? The technology today, we're going on, let's see here, 55 years after those bombings started. The technology, the employment, the access to all the materials, access to the means and the training and the tactics to do this are so much further along. And UAVs and FPVs and all kinds of unmanned and robotic vehicles are going to lend a hand to make this kind of bombing campaign, if it were to emerge on a wholesale level, much worse than it ever was in the 1960s and 70s. You might ask yourself, where was the FBI all this time, and why did it take them so long to get to the bottom line and to get to the bottom, as it were, from a forensic or crime detection methodology, these kind of things? Well, you have to remember that the FBI had two things not in its favor. Number one, it was filled with incompetence, and it was filled with folks who were creatures of their leader who had been at the helm of the agency, J. Edgar Hoover. And in 1971, they were on the cusp of a major disclosure. The Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI was an activist group in the United States during the early 1970s. Betty Metzger would write a book on this that I highly recommend, The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. What they did is that Citizens Commission broke into the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and they stole over 1,000 classified documents. Selected documents were mailed anonymously to several U.S. newspapers exposing numerous illegal FBI operations targeting First Amendment-protected activities of U.S. citizens. The complete collection of political documents ripped off from the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, March 8, 1971, was published for the first time in the March 1972 issue of WIN magazine. That was a journal that was associated with the Communist War Resisters League. The documents revealed the secret COINTELPRO operations that were being conducted by the FBI. COINTELPRO is the counterintelligence program in which the FBI, for over a decade, and I suspect that for generations, had been keeping tabs on not only revolutionary movements, but also on communist movements and black movements. Of course, now we're seeing things sort of tied together here. I had mentioned Jim Jones earlier. Yes, he was being tapped and monitored by the FBI, which led to the FBI also monitoring all black guerrilla, black liberation theology, and black liberation movement organizations across the United States. And remember what I mentioned to you about that schism, that bifurcation in the Students for a Democratic Society, in which the Maoists lost to the very identitarian and totalitarian race obsessors in the Castroite factions of the SDS, which would become the Weathermen, and hence the Weather Underground. Those burglars did extensive surveillance of that FBI office to ensure that they knew when the office was empty and when the streets were unlikely to have police patrols. The break-in was perpetrated on the day of Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali's fight. The burglars confirmed in subsequent interviews that this was done in the hope that the building manager, the residents upstairs, would be glued to their radios to hear the summaries of the fight. By the way, to further demonstrate just how keystone cop an organization the FBI was, they launched an investigation into this. They had up to 200 agents working on the case, but it was never solved, and the investigation was closed when the 5-year statute of limitations ran out. The burglars who were considered suspects and who were interviewed by the FBI, including John Raines, Bob Williamson, and Sarah Schumer, did not cooperate or confess. Bonnie Raines, despite being the only burglar for whom the FBI had an actual facial composite, was ironically never named. Now, there was a documentary film about this burglary and its impact called 1971, not to be confused with the brilliant fiction film based on true life called 71 about a British soldier caught up in the Irish Troubles, but I highly recommend that documentary, 1971, if you get a chance to watch it. Now, I bring all of this up to set the stage for why at both the state and the federal level, the Keystone Cops' antics and just rabid incompetence of the law enforcement agencies in tracking down and stopping the violence that was occurring at the time was just something to behold. Look, radical violence was so deeply woven into the fabric of the 1970s in America that many citizens, especially in New York and other hard-hit cities, they accepted it as a part of daily life. As one New Yorker sniffed to the New York Post after an FALN attack in 1977, "Oh, another bombing? Who is it this time?" You know, frankly, when you think about it, it's a difficult attitude to comprehend in a post-911 world when even the smallest pipe bomb draws the attention of hundreds of federal agents and journalists. I wanted to quote the epilogue to Burroughs' book and then discuss it a little bit. Quote, "On a cool evening in November 2010, 200 people gathered at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Center in Harlem for a memorial service, celebrating the life of Marilyn Buck, who had died of cancer that summer just a month after being released from federal prison. She had served 25 years. The audience was a who's who of the old underground movement. Weather's Kathy Wilkerson sat in a rear corner beside her attorney, Elizabeth Fink. Beside them stood chiseled Ray Levasseur, looking fierce in a black knit cap. Kathy Boudin stood alone at the back. A BLA attorney, Robert Boyle, wandered among the crowd, shaking hands. Up front sat a tall African-American man, Levasseur's old comrade, Kazi Tour. One after another, old friends rose to praise Buck as a poet, a friend, a comrade. Someone read aloud a letter from Sekou Odinga. Amazingly, in more than an hour, no one said the words bombing or bank robbery or murder once. Buck's attorney was the only one who even came close, joking about what Buck would have thought of the Chase Manhattan branch that sat on a street corner outside. A string of special guests was introduced: Linda Evans, the one-time weatherman who was arrested with Buck in 1985, jogged down the aisle, smiling and waving her hands, as did two of the FALN women, friends from prison. About an hour, Wilkerson and Fink rose to leave. This is just too much. This is ridiculous. This movement is dying and no one here seems to know it, Fink said. These people are just deluded. This is crazy. No one that evening was in the mood to provide an honest assessment of what, if anything, the 1970s era underground had achieved. But in terms of tangible successes, of hard-won political or moral victories, the short answer has to be not much. They had launched a kind of war on America, and they had lost. Talk to the underground's veterans today, many of them in their 60s, most mellowed, some not, and almost all are hard-pressed to point to any lasting impact the underground had on American society, short of metal detectors and bomb-sniffing dogs. While it drew the attention of law enforcement for more than a decade, the underground did little to force changes in the way America acted or was governed. Looking back across the chasm of 40 years, those who pursued armed struggle might best be compared to the German werewolf guerrillas who briefly attempted to resist Allied forces after the end of World War II, or to those Japanese infantrymen who emerged days from Pacific Island caves, decades after the war's end, not realizing that the fighting had stopped years before. It was all a mistake, Sekou Odinga admits today. People weren't ready. People weren't ready for armed struggle. One of the things we know now, and should have known then, is we were way out in front of the American people. A little more study would have made that clear. You could be a vanguard in the struggle, but you have to have the people behind you, and they weren't. End of quote. This kind of delusion that you're seeing in this anecdote from 2010, this kind of rationalization of bad and evil behavior, is no different than what we are witnessing today. The thing that I want to emphasize the most in this particular episode is that none of this is new. This is all the same as it ever was. There's nothing here that hasn't resonated through the ages if we confine ourselves simply to the 20th century. What we discover is that between 1916 and 1922, there was an armed struggle in Ireland, starting with the failed rising in 1916, but rising as a result of British existential fatigue after World War I, and the 800-year marker of British society in its overweening suzerainty and its brutal occupation of Ireland. An occupation that would lead after 1922 with the Irish Free State, thanks to Eamon de Valera and Michael Collins, to World War II occurring and the Irish wanting to side with the Germans. How bad do you have to be to align yourself with the Nazis in the Anglophone world? Well, the British managed to do that. As I'm fond of saying, the British win all of their military victories in spite of their best efforts. Armed struggle in America was decided in 1865 for the European civilization that was here. It was decided by 1924 with the last quelling of Apache uprisings for the Aboriginal armed struggle in America. But since that period of time, there has been no successful armed struggle. And now what we're seeing in this day and age, in this first quarter of the new millennium, is the usual suspects are emerging from the campuses and our political landscape in making the requisite noises that an armed struggle is possible, that political assassination is on the menu again, boys, and that possibly bombs and struggle and protest and all kinds of other societal responses to perceived oppression are going to happen again. Well, it just so happens that when it comes to warfare, when it comes to armed struggle, not only do the folks like the SDS, the Weathermen, the Weather Underground, and other radical organizations in American history, not only do they get a vote, but the American people get a vote, and other factions get a vote. And if you don't take that into account,
you're going to be very disappointed with what happens. As I just read from Burroughs' excerpt from his book, Days of Rage, it seems that in spite of, quote, mellowing, end of quote, still some of them stick to their guns, pun intended, on what they did by, for the most part, targeting innocents for political theatrics. This is terrorism, as I've described before. Caleb Carr says that terrorism is the use of political violence against innocents and non-combatants to score political wins. Well, that's not what happens in the end. This year just so happens to mark the 40th anniversary of the May 1985 blowing up of an entire city block in Philadelphia with an improvised bomb on a residential home that housed the black revolutionary organization called MOVE. MOVE was a family of, to quote themselves, strong, serious, deeply committed revolutionaries founded by a wise, perceptive, strategically minded black man named John Africa. The principle of our belief is explained in a collection of writings we call The Guidelines, authored by John Africa. They emerged in the early 1970s as the American Christian Movement for Life, or the Christian Life Movement. Vincent Liebhardt, 1931 to 85, who later took the name Johnny Africa, founded the group and wrote the foundational document known as the Book of Guidelines. Eventually, it was called the Teaching of John Africa. The first major confrontation between MOVE and the police led to a shootout in Powelton Village in Philadelphia on August 8, 1978, which left police officer James J. Ramp dead and 9 MOVE members in jail for life. This would lead, of course, 7 years later to, after a string of violence and confrontation, to the Philadelphia police bombing the MOVE headquarters. And remember, this is 2 years after Monday, November 7th, 1983, when a thunderous explosion tore through the second floor of the Capitol's North Wing, that would be that Capitol, the United States Senate. The adjacent halls were virtually deserted. Many lives were spared because it happened at 2300 hours that evening. Most likely it was done on purpose that hour to minimize casualties. Minutes before the blast, a caller claiming to represent the Armed Resistance Unit had warned the Capitol switchboard that a bomb had been placed near the chamber in retaliation for recent U.S. military involvement in Grenada and Lebanon. And remember, with Grenada, it was the toppling of a Castroite Cuban regime that the Cubans had sponsored on the island of Grenada. And in Lebanon, it was after the barracks bombing and the subsequent retaliation that occurred with that. Now, up until 1993, between 1985 and 1993, when the MOVE building was obliterated by police employing a bomb, which was, I think, one of the first times that that was done in an urban area. But nonetheless, on 26 February 1993, at about 17 minutes past noon, a thunderous explosion rocked Lower Manhattan. The parking garage below the World Trade Center had a 100-foot crater, several stories deep and several more high. 6 people were killed almost instantly. Middle Eastern terrorism had arrived on American soil with a bang. Now, this Middle Eastern terrorism would take front and center. It would take center stage for bombings in America from this point forward. Of course, fast forwarding from 1993 to September 11th and what happens then, for a variety of reasons that we don't have to go into in this episode, it started to remove from the spotlight the bombing activities, which had been at a low ebb starting in the middle 1980s. And all of a sudden, it wasn't a domestic bombing campaign that would occur, but an extraterritorial, terroristic foreign entity that would be in the spotlight from this time forward. So here we are. We've just arrived, as I just mentioned, at the cusp of the 21st century. the new millennium. We're 25 years on now. And what I'd like to cover in the next episode is why America, with the two episodes under your belt that you've just listened to, I think it gives you sufficient background and reinforcement that communist insurgency in America in the 21st century is nothing new, in that this has been here for a long time. But there are a number of factors that are going to make this fight brand new. One of those factors will be the fact that because of the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, lesser so Syria, Libya, and Yemen, and others, that we have a considerable number of folks on both sides of the aisle and both sides of the fight who are very well-versed and proficient in the use of improvised explosive devices, IEDs, small arms, small unit tactics, things like that. What we will discover, using the parlance that is so popular, is that the right of center competency and talent stacks, when it comes to what I just mentioned, far outstrips what the left of center folks have to offer. But the left of center folks also come to this with a dynamic that has not been either animated on the left or the fire hasn't burned long enough, in which they are committed to political violence in a fashion that, for the most part, the American right is unaccustomed to. But it doesn't mean that this won't create the circumstances in which Newton's third law births the makings of a civil war on American soil. I happen to think that, as I've mentioned in other episodes, especially with observations about what's happening in the United Kingdom and Europe and such, is that civil war is now more so a probability than a possibility. And the kind of sectarian violence that we used to look at past our shores may very well be coming to our shores. This also comes on the heels of something rather disturbing, which is where I spent those many episodes in my Storming America series, where I talked about foreign cells coming here with ill and evil intent. And what's going to happen if those foreign cells rise up to conduct their mayhem and either deliberately or accidentally find themselves allied with affiliates or actual trigger pullers in the Antifa and affiliated communist insurgents movement in the United States, what will that do? Well, we'll discuss that in the next few episodes. I don't quite know where this is going to go as far as the number of episodes that I'm going to devote to this examination of Antifa and its affiliates, because I find time and again, as I did with these two episodes, that I'm discovering things that even I wasn't aware of and trying to put the pieces together and make the connections to see just where this leads. Remember, we don't do predictions here, we do forecasting. It's a cheat on my part because the evidentiary bar for forecasts is less stringent than that of predictions. So thank you for listening, and I really appreciate hearing from my listeners and correspondents. You can get in touch with me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. I have a Substack for Chasing Ghosts. You will find that in the show notes. And also, if you have recommendations, comments, gentlemanly discourse that you wish to participate in on this subject, or maybe the previous 72 episodes that I've done in Chasing Ghosts, or the, I think I'm at 19 episodes on War Notes, a conflict podcast, be sure to get in touch with me. And again, thanks for your listenership. And if you would be so kind as to recommend this, if you like it, to family, friends, acquaintances, business folks who you think might be interested, I would be obliged. If you could leave a 4- or 5-starred review, I'd be even more obliged. And if you could leave a narrative review, I'm forever in your debt. So this is Bill out.